New York, like London, is in a class of its own, but even more so. Its most exclusive addresses play second fiddle to none on the planet, from the Dakota on the Upper West Side, where John Lennon was a resident, to 740 Park Avenue, profiled in Michael Gross's 740 Park, the story of the world's richest apartment building. Once home to the Rockefellers and the family of Jacqueline Kennedy, 740 Park is now the residence of a number of New York's most famous billionaires. Leveraged buyout pioneer Henry Kravis, private equity titan Steven Schwarzman, and Revlon owner Ron Perlman all have homes at the famed address. The lobby to the building is subdued and the security is discreet, which isn't to say that once you enter the apartments, such subtlety is the norm. I once had dinner at the Kravis' apartment, which occupies three floors of the building, and while the evening could not have been more pleasant or convivial, I certainly had the sense that I had entered an alternative universe. A maid greeted my guest and me and led us from the elevator through a gorgeous antique-laden hall into a drawing room in which the gilded paneling, 18th-century French furniture, and resplendent paintings by some of Europe's greatest artists were awe-inspiring. Dinner was a more subdued affair, in which the other guests included literary agent Mort Janklow, former Deputy Treasury Secretary Roger Altman, and, to my immediate left, Canadian publishing magnate and later convicted felon Conrad Black. Black flirted vigorously with my date, despite the presence of his own wife, as the others debated the relative promise of the world's emerging markets, all the while eating off of China, each piece of which would literally have supported one family in some of those markets for a year. It was breathtaking and, for one visitor, confirmed the building's reputation. Steven Schwarzman, during lunch in the grill room of the Four Seasons restaurant on Park Avenue, brought more of the carefully circumscribed world of the elite into focus. Our conversation was friendly and relaxed over chopped salads and Diet Cokes. The table at which we sat side by side looked out over the rest of a room filled with the likes of David Rockefeller, Washington power broker Vernon Jordan, CEOs from the financial world, the media, the fashion industry. It was as though we were in the cafeteria of the superclass. This was where those who spend their days running giant enterprises come to casually mingle with one another as they hop from table to table, working the room, planning formal meetings, advancing ideas, spreading gossip. Schwarzman, chief executive of the Blackstone Group, is now acknowledged to be one of the financial world's most powerful men, but he has been prominent on Wall Street for two decades. Today, he has assumed roles of prominence across some of the core institutions of American society. He is chairman of the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts and a board member of the New York Public Library, the New York City Ballet, the Film Society of Lincoln Center, and the New York City Partnership. Much like a good address or the right table at the Four Seasons, such roles enable him to build his networks and advance his interests, tying him in ever more ways to the other members of the leadership communities he seeks to interact with, to do business with, or to influence. "The world is pretty small," Schwarzman told me during our lunch. "In almost every one of the areas in which I am dealing or in which we at Blackstone are looking at deals, you find it is just 20... 30 or 50 people worldwide who ultimately drive the industry or the sector." He notes that his business networks are augmented by the networks he makes serving on the boards of artistic institutions. They afford many opportunities to meet with other similarly inclined members of the elite and to open new relationships, because, just as in business, the world of top artists is interconnected. "The arts," he observed, "are its own subgroup, and the heads of the major companies in the arts know each other. They develop repertory and other productions that they want to sell to their audiences, not just in their home countries, but on a more global basis. Companies travel now. We constantly have different groups at the Kennedy Center, whether it is from Russia or England or Denmark or China or Japan. And so there is almost a seamless subworld in the performing arts, much like the ones you'll find in banking or in politics or business. And people would be just as comfortable dealing with somebody in England or in St. Petersburg." In fact, more so than maybe somebody from their own country who is located two states over doing a completely different line of work. It is a very transparent, porous world. Schwartzman is one of a special breed within the superclass, the crossover elites who are as dominant in finance and business as they are in the arts. He points out that Blackstone today controls companies with over 350,000 employees. That would make us one of the Fortune 20 if we were an industrial company, he commented. That also, by extension, translates into significant influence for Blackstone's major investors, such as China, whose $3 billion stake must be seen as a two-way street, as the people of China become increasingly dependent on the success of the capital system to preserve and expand their national patrimony, and as Blackstone gains access within the PRC. Schwartzman is not unique in his role as a connector, linking several domains of power. The power elite contains interlocking directorships, not only of companies, but of society as a whole. Leadership communities connect across all the important power clusters, business and finance, politics, the military-industrial complex, and the arts and the world of ideas. In fact, such linkages are as distinguishing a characteristic of members of the superclass as wealth or individual position. Trace them and you will find a daisy chain of connections linking remarkably diverse groups. Such connections reduce the degrees of separation between individuals, enabling them to get to the people they need directly, when they need them, to operate at the highest level as efficiently as possible, and, in so doing, to maintain their status, because access to that level is so jealously guarded by those who have it. A quick glimpse of a few superclass members drawn from my list reveals the multiple ways such connections may emerge, and parallels in the approach to power and its maintenance and uses that is emblematic of the group as a whole. Schwartzman can, for the purposes of illustration, be the first in a chain of interconnected superclass members. A quick look at his background offers a number of affiliations that carry with them important networks. One, of course, is that he is chairman of the Blackstone Group. Consider the following language about its variety of holdings from its website. Blackstone has invested in over 100 companies in a variety of industries, geographies, and economic environments. Blackstone's current holdings include such diverse companies as Celanese, Cineworld, Extended Stay America, FGIC, Freedom Communications, Graham Packaging, Health Markets, Houghton Mifflin, Nalco, Orangina, Southern Cross NHP, SunGard, Travelport, TRW Automotive, TDC, Universal Orlando, Vanguard Health Systems, and VNU. The total enterprise value of all transactions effected up to December 31, 2006 is over $191 billion. In many of its investments, Blackstone has partnered with leading corporations around the world, including Time Warner, Six Flags Transaction, AT&T, Bresnan Transaction, Northrop Grumman, Sony, Union Carbide, Union Pacific, CNW Transaction, USX, and Vivendi. Schwartzman graduated from an elite university, Yale, where he was, like both Presidents Bush, a member of the secret society Skull and Bones. He also, like the younger Bush, had an MBA from Harvard. He worked at Lehman Brothers before teaming up with former Commerce Secretary Pete Peterson to found Blackstone. Today, in addition to the cultural board memberships cited earlier and those board relationships associated with his work at Blackstone, he is a member of the Business Council, the British American Business Council International Advisory Board, the J.P. Morgan National Advisory Board, the World Economic Forum, the Council on Foreign Relations, and the Committee to Encourage Corporate Philanthropy. Such boards and memberships offer direct connections to a wide variety of other leaders, and so the daisy chain begins. For example, other members of the J.P. Morgan Advisory Network include, from Japan, former chairman and president of Mitsubishi Corporation, Minoru Makihara. One of India's richest men, Ratan Tata of Tata Industries, and former Mexican president Ernesto Zedillo. Makihara attended Harvard, albeit a decade and a half before Schwarzman. Zedillo got his M.A. and Ph.D. at Yale. Tata is also a member of the British American Business Council International Advisory Board. There, he and Schwarzman are joined by current BP chairman and former director general of the World Trade Organization, Peter Sutherland, recently retired BP CEO, Lord Brown of Mattingly, and Jeffrey Immelt, chairman and CEO of GE. Immelt attended Dartmouth and got his MBA at Harvard. GE has partnered with the Tata Group and done deals with Blackstone. Sutherland, Zedillo, and Makihara are all members of the Trilateral Commission, a non-governmental policy group where they are joined by Pepsi CEO Indra Nooyi and by Banesto Executive Chairman and one of Europe's most powerful female executives, Anna Botan. Nooyi got her M.A. from the Yale School of Management and serves on the board of Lincoln Center with Schwarzman. Botan is a former vice president of J.P. Morgan. Nooyi is a trustee of the Asia Society and Tata is a member, as is Tata's rival as India's most important business leader, Mukesh Ambani. Ambani, Schwarzman, Sutherland, and Zedillo are all members of the Council on Foreign Relations. Sutherland, Zedillo, and Ambani's former partner, Akhil Gupta, are on the board of the World Economic Forum. Botan and Ambani co-chaired a panel at Davos in 2006. Schwarzman, Sutherland, Zedillo, and Ambani's brother, Anil, are all recent Davos participants. Ambani's graduate business degree is from Stanford, as is Brown's. Ambani, Brown, and Immelt serve together on the board of Catalyst, a corporate advisory organization. Makihara and Zedillo are on the Coca-Cola International Advisory Board. Brown, Immelt, and Schwarzman are members of the Business Council, an association of business leaders. Overwhelming and perhaps confusing as this list may be, it reveals the complex nature of connections among members of the superclass. It is by necessity a partial list for a small cross-section of people, but already it illustrates how tangled the web of relationships between individuals is. For all its twists and turns and intricate linkages, it explains in the clearest way possible how Schwarzman and others in the superclass have come to see their group as such a small world, with everyone just a connection or two away from everyone else. So, among the roughly 6,000 members of the superclass, there are countless threads linking members to one another. Business associations, investments, board memberships, old school ties, exclusive neighborhoods, aviation terminals, meetings, restaurants, hotels. In fact, spread around the world though they are, rare as they may be among the teeming billions on the planet, it is easy to see them as a community and to see the geography of that community take shape, at least in the mind's eye, a geography that stretches from South Kensington to the Upper East Side of Manhattan, from Saint-Tropez to Dubai, from the breeding grounds at Harvard, Yale, Cambridge, and Tokyo University to meeting places on the boards of cultural institutions, banks, and political bodies. Linked together by common interests, a common culture, and private aircraft, these islands become a glittering, superpowered archipelago amid oceans of aspirants and of the disenfranchised, oceans of people who work for them, are buffeted by their market decisions, are swept along by their political impulses, are profoundly influenced by their views. It is not a geography visible on any map, yet it touches lives in the global era more surely than do the fading borders and old distance scales found on any common globe. Over the course of the next several chapters, I try to put that geography into context, in terms of issues, history, and a more detailed look at the membership of this emerging superclass. 6 central issues associated with the superclass. In studying this extraordinary landscape, several central themes regularly arise: power, global inequality, governance, global versus national tension, alternatives, the future. These themes lead to a number of important questions. What is the nature of the power of the superclass? What are its origins and its scope, and how is it likely to evolve? Has the superclass used its power in a self-serving way that has exacerbated global inequality? Is there a link between the growing global inequality of wealth and global inequality in the distribution of power? What are the roots of the inequality? Does the nature of the distribution of power in the global era call into question the relevance of our global legal and governmental institutions? In our effort to preserve national sovereignty in an era demanding transnational governance, are we hampering our ability to address global challenges? Will the divide in interests between the global superclass and national elites be one of the central conflicts of our era, potentially rivaling and in some ways echoing the divide between capitalist and socialist doctrines in the last century? Is this the superclass we would choose if we could choose one? How does the superclass fail to reflect in its composition the public at large, and what are the implications of underrepresenting a number of prominent populations? How is the superclass evolving, and what will that mean for us? If the rise and fall of elites is part of the story of every era, what does the nature of this group and its likely fate suggest about our own? In the remainder of the book, I will deal with each of these, sometimes in discrete chapters, sometimes over several chapters, returning to the points from multiple perspectives. As with any such complex worldscape, cartographers or census takers can tell only part of the story. Parts of it are best viewed from 41,000 feet, where, paradoxically, we can see not only the world to the horizon, but also the superclass up close, speeding through the rarefied air that is regularly home to so many of them. Chapter 2. Ceteris non paribus, Inequality, Backlash, and the New Order. An imbalance between rich and poor is the oldest and most fatal ailment of all republics. Plutarch. On a rainy night, the El Golf neighborhood of Santiago, Chile, could be an elegant corner of any world capital. The cordillera of the Andes that enfolds the city is shrouded in mist, and despite the mountains' awesome size, they simply disappear into the darkness. All signs of the Mapuche Indians and other indigenous people for whom the country has been home for thousands of years have been scrubbed away, pushed back, paved over, built over, towered over by neon signs. A friend who lived in Chile once told me of a conversation she had with a group of bright, liberal, enlightened Chileans, in which one, a Chilean diplomat, asserted that the country had no indigenous people to speak of. He was right, of course, because while the Mapuche and other native groups make up more than 5% of Chile's population, this guy and his friend simply didn't want to speak of them. When challenged by my friend, they explained that they meant native peoples weren't visible everywhere as they are in neighboring countries like Bolivia and Peru. In those countries, indigenous groups are not only visible, but in recent years, after an absence of half a millennium, have resumed top positions in their national political lives. But what my friend's Chilean acquaintances revealed was a desire to separate themselves from those native roots, to cast themselves as something different, residents of a piece of Europe that had somehow drifted westward, perhaps, or young globalites representing a culture without a country. Economically, Chile has no peer in Latin America. It is truly sui generis, a model of development and a reminder of what other countries might be if they got their acts together. In a way, Chile has taken a page out of the marketing handbook of 7-Up, the American soft drink. As 7-Up is the un-cola, Chile sells itself to investors as the un-Latin America. When the current foreign minister, Alejandro Foxley, crafted an initiative to link Chile to like-minded countries, for example, his list included Ireland, New Zealand, and Norway, and no countries from South America. El Golf has all the obvious trappings of global capitalism: tall towers and Starbucks, malls and Mercedes's, TGI Fridays and BMWs, all marked as both the most privileged and the most global part of town. Indeed, it is perhaps the most sophisticated such urban neighborhood in all of Latin America. Residents of Recoleta in Buenos Aires or the Jardin district of Sao Paulo might argue otherwise, but El Golf can certainly hold its own with any of them. Some of Chile's richest reside in gated enclaves on the nearby edges of Santiago, while others among the country's upper crust have their vineyards or houses by the sea in Zapallar or Viña del Mar. But El Golf, for all its corporatized, globalized, name-branded sterility, is perhaps the ultimate expression of the Chilean miracle. Chile is the first country in Latin America to escape the cycles of boom and bust, eschewing empty populism and finding both sustained growth and stability. How did this happen? Chile's geography, location, and size shaped an independent-minded country, fairly isolated from its neighbors and possessing a natural impulse to look outward. Its back is literally against the wall of Latin America. The towering Andes Mountains form most of Chile's 6,000-kilometer border with the continent, almost all with Argentina. The historical relations between the two countries may be illustrated best by the fact that, despite the existence of 13 major mountain passes connecting them, only one features a paved road, even today. The prospects for a more benign relationship with Chile's other closest neighbors, Bolivia and Peru, declined after the 1879 War of the Pacific. At the time, Chile claimed an important section of the Atacama Desert that included Bolivia's only seaport, Antofagasta, and seized the Tacna and Arica provinces from Peru. They are wounds that still fester. So Chile had no choice but to look to the sea and beyond. The country's natural resources, copper, timber, agriculture, and fisheries, among others, gave it goods that the world wanted, and despite its location at the far end of the earth, so far off that it is the favored jumping-off point for trips to Antarctica, it immediately had the makings of an attractive trading partner. It was helped in this respect by its early and committed adoption of the market-oriented economic prescriptions of the Chicago Boys, top economists from the University of Chicago and disciples of Nobel Prize winner Milton Friedman. The policies introduced by this group, which called for fiscally disciplined growth and openness to trade and investment, helped fuel Chilean growth for what will soon be two full decades. In effect, Chile chose to be a trailblazer of the new era that is transforming international markets, and today has become something of a poster child for globalization. It has trade agreements with 47 countries and is negotiating with several more, making it one of the most open trading countries in the world. Successive administrations have remained true to the principles introduced in the early 1980s, at the forefront of which is a desire to connect with other nations and let markets work their restorative magic without too much interference from the government, even an avowedly socialist government. As an illustration, I traveled to Chile with then-Commerce Secretary Ron Brown. Our mission was to advocate for American business, and one large American company was eyeing a particularly large Chilean contract that was up for grabs. Brown pleaded our case, only to be interrupted halfway through by the minister with whom we were meeting, saying, "These are good points, Mr. Secretary, but here in Chile the government tries not to get too involved in these matters. We believe if we leave it to the market, the best company will win and the best projects will get done." Brown couldn't help but chuckle. After traveling around the world promoting market doctrine, he had been out-free-marketed. The lessons of the Chicago boys were so well learned, in fact, that they became practically a religion. Although Chile is a mostly Catholic nation, it could also be said to be one that worships at the altar of the Washington Consensus, the prescription of market-oriented reforms that became the primary intellectual product offered by the IMF, the World Bank, and other mainstream international financial institutions during the 1990s. The term was coined by John Williamson of Washington's Institute for International Economics in a 1989 paper in which he described how old and generally discredited development ideas that had resulted in, among other things, the regional debt crisis of the 80s had been overtaken by what he described as a list of 10 policies that I thought more or less everyone in Washington would agree were needed more or less everywhere in Latin America. As Williamson himself has acknowledged, the list of policy ideas, ranging from privatization to fiscal discipline to broad economic liberalization, has been somewhat lost in the outcry that the term implied the ideas were imposed by Washington, when they really represented an emerging post-Cold War consensus about the role of markets and the state. Controversy aside, Chile was so successful in applying the formula, with average growth of around 8% a year in the 1990s, that it has often been held up as an example of how to make development work in the global era, not just in Latin America, but around the world. Just ask the Russians, who, when communism tottered, were advised to consider the Chilean model. Not all boats are lifted. The neighborhood through which we were driving stands as a monument to that history of success. It is a corner of an ancient and beautiful city that is, in some ways, more connected to New York and Singapore by ideology, temperament, and even culture than it is to poorer neighborhoods a few blocks away. Office towers and gated apartment blocks rise up like graphics on a bar chart, tracking an irrefutable and remarkable rise. Yet off in the darkness, somewhere off the chart, as invisible as the mountains at night, there is the remaining conundrum with which the country's leaders still struggle. Today, Chile's poorest are farther away in economic terms from Chile's richest than at any time in its modern history. The top 20% of Chileans earn almost 67% of the country's income, while the bottom 20% earn just over 3%. Indeed, not only is the gap between rich and poor in Chile worse than it was during the decidedly unsentimental Pinochet years, it is almost the worst in the world on a continent sadly marked by the distinction of producing the worst inequality indicators on the planet. As the taxi driver sent us skittering down the wet side streets with completely unjustified assertiveness given that he clearly had no idea where he was going, I couldn't help but wonder why the famous rising tide wasn't lifting all boats as it should. Some of my development economist friends would point out that the bottom is in fact rising modestly in many places around the world, and that is a positive trend to be sure. But is it tolerable or even sustainable that the gaps that do exist are so egregious that the economic prescriptions of our age have helped the richest, not just more, but almost inconceivably much more? Yes, the incentives given to business and investment leaders to motivate them to work harder and trigger growth benefit all. But are the incentives really market incentives predicated on unfettered economic interaction? Or has the system been fine-tuned to disproportionately benefit those who lead organizations, make investment decisions, and run boardrooms? It is true that governments have been unable to do much of what they should to improve the welfare of their people, and in a vast number of cases, markets have done much more. But is creating a false choice between governments and markets, as so many politicians have done, productive or practical, when neither can do the job of creating a thriving or just society alone? Perhaps to distract myself from the insane maneuvering of my cab driver, who, like cab drivers the world over, was more focused on his cell phone conversation than the well-being of his passengers, I thought back to the conversation with Lawrence Summers at the Charles Hotel in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Summers had suggested that the reason the most economically successful members of society are getting so much more might be that the world is actually becoming more efficient. The system is rewarding the more skilled at proportionally higher rates, giving those with access to technology greater rewards for their heightened productivity, and giving those leading enterprises of growing scale greater returns for their company's incremental growth. Unfettered markets are doing their job. Isn't it possible, he was positing, that overachievers are now finally able to capture their fair share of returns, given their relative talents, productivity, and contribution of value to economic outcomes? Not a country, but a country club. Summers's point haunted me as we drove through the streets of Chile on our way to a dinner party with one of his former Harvard colleagues, Andreas Velasco, the country's finance minister. In Chile, one cannot help but be struck by the very stratified nature of society. There are the poor and the working class, and there are the fairly well-to-do and educated who are making the Chilean miracle work. And then there are the few at the very top of the business world who reap hugely disproportionate rewards from that miracle. In fact, for all its progress, Chile is much like a number of other countries in the developing world, in that it has a handful of elite families and individuals who dominate. It is true of the oligarchs of Russia, the men and women who run Korea's Chaebol, the leading family-owned companies of the Philippines and elsewhere in Southeast Asia, and here in successful Chile. A close Chilean friend who rose up from a privileged corner of that small society once described Chile to me as being not so much a country as a country club. The club includes a few key families: Angelini, Mata, Piñera, Luksic, Sayi, Claro, Edwards, and a handful of others. According to my friend, that's the inner circle, and to get anything meaningful done, you need some of them on your side. While this statement is something of an oversimplification, there is much truth in it. Each of these families controls a few key enterprises: timber or airlines or banking or shipping or media, and related groups that produce a wide range of products and services. A few have billionaires among their ranks, such as Anaclito Angelini, Eliodoro Mata, and Sebastian Piñera. Nearly all have significant political clout. Piñera, owner of the country's leading airline, LAN Chile, for example, was the right's candidate for president of Chile in the last election cycle. He is handsome, articulate, self-confident to a fault, and a good and impassioned speaker whose only oratorical weakness is a fondness for hearing his own voice. He did well in the elections, and as one of the country's richest men and one of the leading voices of the opposition to the socialist government, is a major force in the political, economic, and social life in Chile. Listening to Piñera, one cannot help but believe he is sincere in his desire to help Chile grow, and in his belief that the approaches he advocates are the right ones. This is also an increasingly cosmopolitan group. Talk to any of them and you see very sophisticated, well-educated, often comparatively enlightened global business leaders. Earlier in 2007, I spoke with Andronico Luksic in his office at the Banco de Chile, Chile's leading privately owned bank, about his active involvement in the markets of Asia. His bank had just opened offices in Vietnam and completed a major investment in Pakistan, and Luksic himself had, in fact, just purchased an apartment in Beijing so that he could get a sense of the people and of the place. His perspective was clear. This is the fastest growing market in the world in the middle of a large number of other fast growing markets, he told me, and I want to get a part of that business. Also, I don't think Chile can compete unless we have close ties and active trade with China and the rest of Asia. That's the future. Luksic understands as well as anyone in the country what it will take to help Chile grow. He is forward-looking and creative, and regularly consults with President Michelle Bachelet and her government about issues of policy and priorities, often advocating policies that he and others like him in the business community feel will make the country more globally competitive, from improving education to reducing red tape that is seen as an obstacle to investment. He takes part in global conferences like the World Economic Forum's Latin American Business Summit, which he co-chaired in 2007. He, like the others, is as comfortable on Wall Street or in global markets as any business leader you would meet anywhere in the world. There is nothing the least bit provincial or disconnected about this group, as there might have been about most Latin business giants, say, 20 or 30 years ago. Soon after visiting with Luksic, I spent an afternoon with Alvaro Saya, a leader of the Chilean business community who also made his money in banking. We met in his mansion, which sits atop a long and twisting road in the foothills of the Andes overlooking Santiago. Turning through the gate into the driveway, one finds a modern triumph of design, evocative of a Roman courtyard, yet full of clean lines that are exceptionally sophisticated and aesthetically pleasing. Saya, too, is a thoughtful man, deeply concerned about Chile's future and particularly passionate on the issue of education. He would like to help endow and build a new university for the country, one that will help educate new generations of leaders to be more competitive in the world. "We cannot be complacent," he said. "To continue to grow, to lead, to solve our problems, we have to push ourselves forward." Despite his lavish residence, far removed from the dirty streets of the city, Saya recognizes his country's shortcomings and wants to use his fortune to find a solution. Like Luksic, he uses international organizations of business leaders as a way to better understand current thinking worldwide and to expand his network of connections. For example, he is an active member of the Group of 50, an organization of some of the hemisphere's most important business leaders who meet once a year, typically in Washington, but recently in locations as far-flung as China and Santiago. Yes, Chile's elites are promoting growth and progress and, in some cases, concrete measures to address the country's persistent inequality. But conversations with these elites often contain sub-themes that offer a more complex picture. Speaking with a top executive of one of the country's leading timber companies, I could detect something like an unhealthy comfort with and support for the status quo. His company dominates the market, and when asked whether Chile needs to do more to stimulate foreign investment, the CEO became hesitant. "Yes, investment is good," he observed slowly, but his words and the pauses he took as he chose those words implied otherwise. Competition from major multinationals is viewed, understandably, with much wariness. Thus far, in each of Chile's major sectors, only a couple of companies dominate, typically either locally owned companies or companies with ties to significant local interests. Entrepreneurial activity is noticeably constrained, with few big success stories emerging from small and medium-sized enterprises. Chile has grown and modernized, but the social and structural status quo has remained remarkably unchanged, a truth not wholly disagreeable to members of the elite like the timber executive. In many ways, the distribution of wealth and power can be traced to historical inequalities dating back to the colonial era, not just in Chile, but throughout Latin America. Those inequities, in turn, have been perpetuated by the fact that key assets that could have promoted greater equality were available primarily to elites, such as education, which, when available mostly to the few, actually worsens disparities. When the issue of addressing such historical imbalances arose in discussion among the handful of Chile's dominant business leaders, however, most framed their answers in the language of the Chicago boys. Ricardo Claro, the head of shipping giant CSAV and owner of one of Chile's most famous vineyards, Santa Rita, supported orthodox economic reforms during the Pinochet years. Intellectually curious and exceptionally intelligent, he is also worldly, active in elite international circles, and well known outside Chile. But the message that he and many others in the Chilean business establishment offer in conversation, directly or by implication, is a particularly distilled version of the economic prescriptions from the 1980s. Leave it to the markets. Be patient. Keep taxes low for those who create jobs. They adhere to the axiom of trickle-down 25 years after the term was coined, even as compelling evidence has built up that, as Cornell University economist Robert H. Frank has written, trickle-down theory is supported neither by economic theory nor by empirical evidence. Not just a Chilean paradox. Our taxi finally arrived at our destination, a modern white stone apartment building. From the front door, a maid ushered us across a pristine marble lobby and into a tiny elevator, which took us up to the apartment of the chairman of Chilectra, one of two major electric utilities in Chile. As we proceeded, the seeming paradox of Chilean progress remained heavy on my mind. How could the country be so advanced, with a cadre of leaders who are so well-educated and cosmopolitan, and yet be home to such intractable problems of income and social inequality? Entering the apartment, the first person I saw was Andreas Velasco, whose finance ministry, for the record, has been a sometime client of my consulting firm. He was seated in one of those living room chairs of Scandinavian design that are virtually impossible to get comfortable in. Yet somehow he appeared comfortable and even serene. Beside him sat our host, Jorge Rosenbluth, who was a senior official in a previous Chilean administration and one of the top fundraisers for current President Bachelet. We were soon joined by the Minister of the Presidency, Ricardo Lagos Weber, the Undersecretary of Finance, Maria Olivia Recart, and the head of the Finance Ministry's International Division, Raúl Saez. It was a casual discussion among friends, with no business transacted and plenty of very good Chilean wine consumed. Chile's numerous successes were easy enough to understand. Velasco, who had a brilliant career as an economist, leading to his tenured appointment to Harvard's economics department, is a truly blue-chip finance minister, the latest in a long line that has included current foreign minister Alejandro Foxley and former deputy IMF managing director Eduardo Ananat. He had recently convinced the country to save instead of spend nearly $20 billion in profits from high copper prices, the kind of move that has led global financial markets to have growing confidence in Chile. When the issue of inequality first came up early in the evening, Velasco was very thoughtful about it. It obviously troubled him. Clearly, this is a central problem for us, and a vitally important one for our future, he said. There is much work that remains to be done on this front, just in terms of framing the problem, even before we begin to tackle it. What are the causes? What are our real options? What are the cures that will not make the disease worse? We need to come to grips with problems within our education system, with infrastructure, with job creation, with really opening our economy. But when it was suggested that meaningful changes would require broad political support, Lagos Weber and the others shook their heads and suppressed smiles. There are opponents of change in the establishment on both the right and the left. They see social spending as potentially inflationary. They view educational reform as overly complicated. And most important, with reference to the key leaders of the business community, Rosenbluth noted that the group that has the most power within the Chilean business community is just too comfortable in this 21st century, and the ones who are uncomfortable, the small and medium-sized enterprises, don't have that much influence. Many of the charter members of the Country Club see no need to change the membership rules. The dinner party guests were too polite or too politic to say it, but the reality is that while many of the most powerful people in the country embrace progress, they use their energy and political capital primarily on behalf of the changes that benefit them most directly. Elites in Chile have implicitly or explicitly resisted the changes that might create more competition, more entrepreneurship, more access to capital for the poor and middle classes. The doctrine of the Chicago Boys says that's okay, because it is the doctrine of the rising tide and trickle-down, a Reagan-era vintage that, as noted, has not aged as well as the Chilean reds and whites that were highlights of our meal. The mainstream suggestion has always been that patience would be enough. Promoting competition and opening to investment would someday translate into creating real opportunity for everyone and making capital much more broadly available. You can call the ideas underlying that vintage Reagan-Thatcherism, or you can, in a nod to the intellectual leaders who have driven the phenomenon, call them Volcker-Greenspanism after the high priests at the U.S. Central Bank. I once heard someone, seeking to frame them in terms of free markets and globalization, call them Friedman-Friedmanism, after the Chicago Boys' mentor Milton and Thomas, author of The World is Flat. But perhaps the best way to characterize this family of ideas is market-marketism, the notion that central planning and big government have proved such a bust that the best way to solve any of society's problems is by leaving it to the markets. But more than a generation after this doctrine began to be embraced by the world's most influential people, by the evolving new global elite, it is now clear that it leaves many questions unanswered. Markets are marvels in many respects, and the growth produced by free market policies has benefited billions. But markets don't have consciences, and would sooner leave behind the sick, the untrained, and the aging. Markets seek efficiency, and this often means consolidation of resources and power, economies of scale, and considerable human costs. Market-marketism does not deal sufficiently with the inefficiencies, weaknesses, and failings of markets at producing the kind of just society that is at least as important a goal as fostering prosperity. The genius of the approach is that it suggests good will ultimately come to all in society if we just follow the simple formulas. To me, this sounds a little bit too much like the promise of heavenly rewards that enabled clerical elites to collaborate with political elites throughout history as a way of promoting stability in the face of widespread suffering among the poor. There has to be a better way. There has to be a way that we can harness the power of markets, recognize the limitations of government, and still address the growing, glaring, unjust, and corrupting inequities in our world. Velasco seemed to sense the need for change and new ideas. He clearly doesn't trust most interventionist big government solutions, but he knows that leaving it to the markets is inadequate. Perhaps, he acknowledged, we may be at the beginning of a new period of thinking. Perhaps we need to find a new balance. He recognized that for the past quarter century, the thinking on which he and other mainstream economists were raised, that of constraining the role of government, promoting fiscal austerity, combating inflation, deregulating, and letting market dynamism drive growth, has not had precisely the results expected. Many have gained hugely and others have lagged far behind, and that, he noted, certainly calls for some reflection and likely for some new approaches. But he, like many, doubts that this will or should usher in a new era of greater government activism. Yes, government must take the lead in providing the educational and infrastructural resources necessary to be competitive. Yes, it must play a part in regulating the industries that will likely drive growth tomorrow. I can see there is a role for government there, Velasco says, but how to balance that with the fundamentals, the things we know work, and what we know doesn't work? That is difficult. That's our challenge. And after the easy part, the following day I met with Chile's former Minister of the Economy, Jorge Marshall, in his roomy but dimly lit office. At the time the number two man in Chile's central bank, Marshall tackled the issue another way. We have come a long way here in Chile, he said. We stabilized the economy, controlled inflation, and we then opened up. We embraced privatization and trade liberalization. But the secret is that we did those things because they were, comparatively speaking, the easy things for us to do politically. Fixing the core problems within our society, like the inequality issue, and finding new ways to stimulate growth, those are much harder. The necessary reforms, in other words, may not be politically possible, let alone popular. Chile has achieved a level of economic stability and growth far and above that of many other countries in which inequality remains a huge issue. But as in Chile, the reforms embraced across Latin America and the emerging world over the past two decades were the ones that suited those who were already in positions of power, the small clusters of families that controlled the largest business groups and the small group of political and military leaders with whom they had established relationships. These elites had run things for years, making money regardless of the conditions in their countries. When, after the debt crisis of the 1980s, banks that lent money to these nations sought reforms as a way of ensuring that their rescheduled debts would actually be repaid, the deals these national elites cut were deals they could live with, crafted in negotiations with the bankers for whom they were the only real customers in each country. Paradoxically, while the banks were unhappy with the bad debt that mismanagement had brought to their clients, ultimately they wanted the clients to survive to borrow again another day. That gave great leverage to governments and to the business leaders and local bankers who consulted and cajoled during the negotiations. The elites embraced privatization because they had the assets that allowed them to borrow and to invest and to own the newly privatized entities. They promoted deregulation because it gave more latitude to the business leadership and diminished the role of government leaders. They welcomed market opening because, as owners of large entities, they were the most likely to benefit from new capital flows and the increased trade opportunities. But when it came time to address ownership structures that favored, sometimes grotesquely favored, majority shareholders and diminished the rights of minority shareholders, or that produced more competition, those in power dragged their feet. And as trade liberalization connected them to the world, they began to recognize that keeping labor costs down in their countries would help them attract investment capital. Their interests actually grew less and less aligned with those of their workers, and more tied to those of the investment bankers and others who could offer them big paydays or accelerated growth, read, wealth creation, for their companies. This was possible largely because the term free market, a bumper sticker description of the complex ideas described among those of Williamson's Washington Consensus, is typically a misnomer. There are always rules, those set by governments, like tax structures and incentives, often tuned to promote the development interests successfully promoted by segments of the business community, and those inherent to markets, like the fact that cost efficiency favors the creation of entities of scale, and compensation structures for bankers favor doing fewer big deals for big companies, which also typically have better credit profiles, rather than many for smaller companies or for individuals. Even today, while micro-lending and other programs target poor individuals, the vast majority of investment capital goes to the biggest firms. In Chile, leaders have cited this as a particular concern linked to underdevelopment of small to medium-sized enterprises in that country. Amid all this, other factors not traditionally or effectively studied by economists, loomed large and remained largely unaddressed. Among these were issues of a culture that maintained many elements of class structure even in the face of reform. It is an awkward subject to raise because culture is tied up in national identity and religion and even race, and thus is kind of a radioactive subject in development circles, seldom spoken of in polite wonk society. But it is a fact. Just as we are coming to the painful realization that introducing the institutions of democracy without promoting the true culture of democracy and freedom produces what Newsweek editor Fareed Zakaria has described as illiberal democracy, Venezuela and Russia are excellent illustrations of the point, we should also be able to see that the same holds true for the institutions and culture of markets. Introducing market structures and approaches without fostering a culture of entrepreneurship or one that promotes genuine equality of opportunity and rights will produce illiberal markets, systems that will appear to be free markets but will be rife with inefficiencies and injustices. The result will most likely foster destabilizing forces, political and otherwise, and will, in any case, constrain societies from achieving their full potential. Any such system requires effective legal frameworks that are actively and fairly enforced, and, to date, often missing. In the global sphere, in the transnational or supranational realm, oftentimes they have never existed. As Harvard's Danny Roderick has written, globalization's soft underbelly is the imbalance between the national scope of governments and the global nature of markets. A healthy economic system necessitates a delicate compromise between these two. Go too much in one direction, and you have protectionism and autarky. Go too much in the other, and you have an unstable world economy with little social and political support for those it is supposed to help. Observers like the Nobel Prize-winning economist and Columbia University professor Joseph Stiglitz have argued that elites in Chile and elsewhere in the world have accepted the reforms that suited them, but they have stopped short of accepting the ones that would do the most for society at large. One of Stiglitz's former colleagues and President Clinton's chief of staff, Mac McClarty, suggested that the issue of resistance to change has a generational component. Generational wealth, and I am generalizing here, but the big families that have been dominant in their economies for a long time, many of them have been disengaged from social issues or concerns, he told me. They just kind of put the blinders on and run their particular enterprises, especially in cases where even the patriarchs today are third or fourth generations of wealth and have been insulated their whole lives. They simply don't get it, or don't want to get it. As a former Fortune 500 CEO, McClarty has known plenty in this moneyed class and seen firsthand the obstinacy that makes reform so difficult. Moises Naim, a former Venezuelan trade and industry minister and the current editor of Foreign Policy magazine, believes that the problem goes beyond passive resistance. In many respects, the elites are responsible for the problems of the regions, he told me recently. How can the Saudi elite not be responsible for what is happening in Saudi Arabia? How can the Venezuelan elite not be responsible for having brought the country to the point where a person like Chavez has ascended to power? Naim carefully delineates his use of the word elites, seeking to avoid some of the old traps of class warfare. He is careful not to overstate their influence, but he agrees that, particularly in the developing world, they have been a significant part of the problem for a long time. My conversations with the leaders of Chile and with experts like McClarty and Naim set off a flood of new questions. If national elites are playing a role in the evolution of inequality at home, do international elites play a similar role on a global scale? How do the aligned interests of global elites influence political, policy, and market developments in these early years of the global era in ways that are affecting inequality? How positively? How negatively? What is the real rather than the imagined role of members of the global elite who exert special influence? Ceteris non paribus, inequality of power, inequality of wealth. If you toss the term inequality into a room full of international economists or policy wonks, it can have the same effect as tossing a rattlesnake into a room full of normal people. All sorts of mayhem ensue. Fierce arguments break out along fine academic divisions. Inadequacies of statistics are cited. Accusations about motives fly. High horses are mounted. Epithets are thrown. But the question is central to any study of the existence of the superclass, because not only are they at the most extreme high end of the inequality continuum, but they are perceived to be the rule setters, and self-interested ones at that. For this reason, we ought to dig a little deeper into the issue of inequality before proceeding on to other dimensions of the superclass, such as its history, its component parts, its impact, and its future. As far as I can tell, there are schools of very distinguished, prize-winning economists who assert via extremely well-substantiated academic papers that global inequality is 1. Increasing, 2. Decreasing, 3. Stabilizing after increasing for some 200 years, 4. The inevitable result of well-functioning markets distributing rewards to the deserving, and or 5. A threat to society that will undermine stability and invalidate our assertions about the progress of civilization. Recently, a long line of books and articles have taken up the cause of inequality, extending the debate beyond academic argument into the field of punditry. Many of these implicitly endorse the theory that inequality is on the rise, and blame it on the ultra-rich and their fellow travelers, the ultra-powerful. These accusations are often aimed even more specifically at the elite advocates and beneficiaries of globalization, who are seen as a force that may be exacerbating inequality. On the other hand, a number of columnists and business magazine editors defend elites for their role in globalization, believing that by globalizing they will ultimately help create a more equitable system. To some, therefore, the members of the superclass are the heroes of the process of globalization that will, someday, help the poorest out of poverty. To others, they are the new robber barons, standing astride what observers from the Financial Times' Martin Wolf to the New York Times' Paul Krugman have called a new Gilded Age, or circling it in their G5. They are either pioneers who earn the benefits they reap, or they are exploiters who should beware the impending backlash or global revolution. But they are, in either case, important to the story of inequality. Now, I'm not one for frittering away time on contorted academic debates while people are starving to death. You can't eat a Gini coefficient, the economic measure of inequality. But I do know a couple of things that are hard to argue with. First, there is economic inequality. Second, it is getting worse in some places. Third, those with the most power are undoubtedly in the best position to fix it, and often also happen to be those who are on the have-lots end of the have-have-not continuum. Consequently, it is important to lay out a few of the basics of the economic inequality picture. Nancy Birdsall, the founding president of the Center for Global Development, explained clearly the link between inequalities of wealth and inequalities of power. In a lecture called "The World Is Not Flat: Inequality and Injustice in Our Global Economy," which she delivered at the United Nations University, Birdsall asserted that as a result of globalization, existing rules tend to benefit most those countries and individuals who already have economic power. It is natural that the richer and more powerful manage to influence the design and implementation of global rules, even those rules meant to constrain them to their own advantage. Agree with the point or not, and I will return to this, if we acknowledge that some people are more powerful than others, then we must attribute to them disproportionate responsibility for the nature of the society over which they have influence. According to the United Nations, despite economic gains in many regions, the world is less equal than it was even a decade ago. Gaps exist within countries and between them. For example, the richest countries in the world, such as the United States, the EU, and Japan, are now on average more than 100 times richer than the poorest, such as Ethiopia, Haiti, and Nepal. 100 years ago, the ratio was closer to 9 to 1. In fact, the ratio between the GDP of today's richest country in per capita GDP terms, Luxembourg, and today's poorest, Guinea-Bissau, is 267 to 1. When 30 years ago the same ratio between the richest, the United States, and the poorest, Bangladesh, was 88 to 1. The world's billionaires, those roughly 1,000 individuals, have combined wealth greater than that of the poorest 2.5 billion. In some places, the concentration of poverty is not unlike the concentration of wealth you find in the United States, Europe, and Japan. In sub-Saharan Africa, almost half of the population lives on less than a dollar a day, while only 3.5% of Europeans live with such agonizing, life-crushing deprivation. Even in China, which has shown such remarkable growth over the past two decades, inequality is increasing. In the period between 1984 and 2004, China's Gini coefficient almost doubled, from 29 to 47. Disputes arise over the interpretation of these figures. One often cited distinction is the difference between measuring inequality among the peoples of a country and inequality among all peoples. The World Bank's Branko Milanovic has argued that measuring intra-country income gaps is a useful metric when testing the effectiveness of policies. By this measure, inequality has been on the rise for almost seven decades, with a period of steady and sharp increase between 1982 and 1994. Some of the lower-income countries, like those in sub-Saharan Africa, have struggled with negative per capita GDP growth for a quarter century, while the developed free trading countries of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development have seen their fortunes rise over the same period. However, as Milanovic notes, if you look at this metric and weigh the increases by population size, global inequality can be seen to have declined. This is due primarily to the performance of the two most heavily weighted nations, China and India, which have seen some income growth. When one excludes China and India from the list, in fact, weighted inequality is shown to have been on the rise since the mid-80s, the same as the unweighted results. However, when seeking to assess inequality not just between countries but among all people, the debate gets a little thicker. Milanovic, in his excellent book, Worlds Apart, asserts that a global survey of household incomes shows true inequality. Inequality across all individuals to be high, with the Gini for all adults in the world nearly 65. He notes that the hollowing out of the middle classes in places like Eastern Europe and Latin America caused global inequality to rise between 1988 and 1993. But this trend reversed from 1993 to 1998 as a result of rising rural incomes in India and China. Professor James Galbraith of the University of Texas takes a similar line on the issue of cross-country inequality. When World Bank economists David Dollar and Art Cray offered an argument that global inequality had been declining since 1975 and that globalizing countries were outperforming non-globalizers, Galbraith shot back. Missing from Dollar and Cray's list of successes are the true globalizers of recent times, he argues, including Argentina, until just a few months ago the leading neoliberal poster child, or Russia, now attempting to recover from the collapse that followed shock globalization. So too are the erstwhile Asian tigers, who liberalized in the early 1990s and failed before the end of the decade. Nor are these examples isolated. World growth rates were systematically higher under the structured international financial regime of Bretton Woods from 1945 to 1971 than they became in the era of deregulation after 1980. Asserting that he works from a bigger, more accurate data set, UN versus World Bank data, Galbraith claims that rising inequality after 1980 is the rule in this data, with limited exceptions mainly in Scandinavia and Southeast Asia before 1997. The patterns strongly suggest that the forces of globalization, including high global interest rates, debt crises, and shock liberalizations, are associated with rising inequality in pay structures. Pay is, of course, the major component of income, and if pay inequalities are rising, it is a good bet that broader income and social inequalities are rising too. Examining inequalities within countries presents a more mixed picture. In the last two decades, income inequality has risen in China, India, and most of Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union, as well as in a number of Latin American countries. In the cases of China and India, extraordinary growth has been heavily concentrated in urban areas, widening the income gap with rural regions. In many countries, inequality has remained relatively stagnant, however, and it appears actually to have declined in a number of both industrialized and developing countries, including Italy, Japan, Bangladesh, Ghana, and the Philippines. Recent studies based on tax data, for example, have found that in the past quarter century, the top income shares increased substantially in many English-speaking countries, but remained unchanged in Japan and much of continental Europe. Emmanuel Saez of the University of California at Berkeley and Thomas Piketty of the Paris School of Economics argue that the rise in top income shares is not due to the revival of top capital incomes, but rather to the very large increases in top wages, especially top executive compensation, beginning in the 1970s and accelerating in the 1990s. In other words, the guys running the big companies started to make a lot more money. There are multiple explanations for this phenomenon. Some cite the growth of the companies in question. Some cite the advent of compensation packages laden with options. Others cite the market benefits of hiring brand-name CEOs and the consequent earning power of high-profile executives. Finally, still others saw it as part of a cycle of self-congratulatory self-dealing among a small community of business leaders who ran companies and served on the boards that approved compensation packages. Whatever the real reasons, the upward spiral of executive pay has in turn triggered another, even more high-profile debate. War of the rich and the super-rich? The prominence of this second debate derives from the fact that, while global income inequality and the plight of the world's poorest are the stuff of lively debate among economists, NGOs, and the philanthropically inclined, it suffers from lack of broader awareness. The people most directly involved are far away and poor, not exactly the type of audience that attracts advertisers in rich countries. This is especially the case in the United States, where stories about the poorest are left to MTV telethons, American Idol Gives Back, and People magazine interviews with Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt. Shift the focus of the story to inequality in the United States, however, and then it starts to get some attention. Better yet, make it a story about the growing gap between the rich and the super rich. Then you get to combine moral outrage with glamour and famous names. Then you've got a story people can care about. In the recent past, we have seen stories titled Revolt of the Fairly Rich. Today's lower upper class is seething about the ultra-wealthy. Fortune. The new rich-rich gap. Newsweek. A new class war. The haves versus the have-mores. In web world, rich now envy the super rich, and richest are leaving even the rich far behind, all from the New York Times. We have also seen a long list of books on the subject, including Robert Frank's aforementioned Richistan, A Journey Through the American Wealth Boom and the Lives of the New Rich. These stories tug at our heartstrings with the plight of the top 1% of American earners, who make over $350,000 a year and who watch in despair as most of the spoils go to the top 0.1%, who average $2.3 million, and the top 0.1%, who average $14 million. As the New York Times explains in its series, Class War, while the percentage change in average real household income between 1990 and 2004 was an increase of 2% for the bottom 90% of American households, it increased 57% for the top 1% and shot up to 85% for the top 0.1% and up to 112% for the top 0.01%. That is, the richest are getting richer almost twice as fast as the rich. And, as is noted but not underscored, while the rich are getting much richer, most everyone else, well, they are just treading water.
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.